History through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, presented on the air and online by Provident Payments, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, a program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories there that should not go untold. And we know they don't have to go untold if we're willing to ask a few questions and take some time to listen. Our goal is to honor our veterans for their service and their sacrifice. We want to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And in that process, yes, we're educated, and yes, we're entertained, but often we also find ourselves inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. This week marks the 80th anniversary of the start of the Battle of Okinawa, the last major land battle of World War II. It started on Easter Sunday, which was April 1st in 1945, and lasted nearly 3 months, with the cost of more than 12,000 American lives, not to mention more than three times that many who survived but came home with Purple Hearts and stories of just how close they came. Next week, we're going to hear from one of the thousands of sailors who got up close and personal with the kamikaze phenomenon during the Battle of Okinawa. But today, we're going to revisit three memorable Okinawa survivor stories in honor of the 80th anniversary. Of the more than 50,000 American casualties at Okinawa were more than 19,000 United States Marines, including one with a colorful nickname who shared his memories with us decades later, Glenn Brehm, a.k.a. Pluto.
We landed there on Easter Sunday, April Fool's Day. It was, April the 1st. I was on there a month and a half before I finally got hit. I think I got hit May the 14th.
Wow. That is a long time. So what were you doing for that month and a half?
Gone, moving up in battles. One day you'd run into trouble, then you'd go 3 or 4 days and nothing would happen. Then you'd move up a little further and run into some more opposition.
What was the hardest thing for you to deal with, or maybe the most terrifying part of the whole experience for you?
Well, it was all terrifying. but remember, they wanted, just 3 days before I got shot, they wanted to send me home to go to officer's candidate school. They said they'd ship me out right now. And I says, no, after this was over, I'd be coming home anyway, because after four campaigns, they automatically sent you home. And then, so 3 days later, then I got shot.
And this is quite a story. And, you know, you come back and you marry Muriel and you would have 5 children. Now there's 15 grandkids and 32 great-grandkids. And this always amazes me. None of those people would be here if your rifle hadn't jammed. That's crazy.
That's what my kids keep telling me.
Tell me what happened. Your rifle jammed?
Yeah.
Where was the situation? Where were you and what was going on?
They had sent two squads of us in. There was some of the guys, another outfit, were trapped in this little valley. And they sent us in. And we could see them getting picked off down there. So I said, boy, no way are we going to, Dad won't take my squad down. It was just then it says, Pluto, get ready. You're going down there. So you have to do it. So they sent a tank in with us. So we were behind the tank going up this little valley, and a mortar shell came in and hit right on the turret of the tank and put that out of commission. So I was right behind it. And when my rifle jammed, I bent over to fix it. And just then it felt like somebody hit me with their fist in the shoulder. And I lay in blood blowing all over, so I knew what happened. So about that time, everybody was getting hit. In fact, the other squad leader got hit with the same bullet that I got hit with. When it exploded, a chunk of it broke his arm.
Wow.
And right after that, we had this one platoon sergeant that was with us. He sent me a picture of himself after he got home. He got hit right through the mouth. It looked like a dimple on each side. It didn't hit a tooth or his tongue or anything.
Wow, what are the odds of that?
And that all happened just within a few minutes. And finally they sent smoke shells in and told us to go back. So you couldn't see anything from here to you, always getting out of that smoke. So we headed back, and I jumped in a shell hole because I got grazed in the arm, but just out of the smoke, a bullet hit me in the arm and it hit my cartridge belt. And then I dove in the shell hole, and I dove in on my right side because this one was hurt, and I broke two ribs, which I didn't know till afterwards, but I broke two ribs, and there were two guys in the hole, and they were two of the ones that we had gone in to try to get out, and they poured sulfa in my shoulder and everything and helped me get up to the top of the ridge, and then they took me back to the medical center then. But by that time, I had lost a lot of blood. I don't know how many pints of blood they gave me.
Yeah.
But I was still able to walk.
Well, I want to hear more about that, but I want to underscore for people because they might be saying, well, wait a second. You said if his rifle hadn't jammed, he wouldn't be here. Well, the implication is if you're not bending over to fix that rifle, you're standing up and the shell hits you where?
It would right in the back or the shoulder. I mean,
it would have just blown you in half.
Oh, yeah. Because I still get pieces that work out, like little pimples coming. I've got, I don't know how many pieces still in my neck.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow. But it would have killed you. There's no question.
Oh, yeah,
you
wouldn't absolutely
be here.
Oh, that's right.
So it's a good thing that rifle jammed. Yeah. But then, so now your shoulder's blown to bits. You dive in the hole. You crack two ribs. You can still walk, but you've lost all this blood. I mean, you've got to be just out of your mind. I can't imagine what was going on.
Yeah. Well, I was just happy to get back to the aid station anyway, and then they worked on me. I can remember the doctor asking me if I wanted to save some of those pieces coming out. I could hear him as he was dropping them in a can. I said, no, I don't want them. I did say, is this going to be enough to get me home? He says, it will. Don't worry about it.
Wow. How long of a process was that for you to recover?
Well, I was, I got hit May the 14th. I got home June the 14th. I'd been in the hospital in Guam for a week and then Pearl Harbor for another couple of weeks, and then I was in the hospital at Pleasanton for a couple of weeks afterwards. But after that, I was able to take care of it myself. But it was such a hole they couldn't stitch it; they had to use clamps to clamp it together because the stitches kept popping. So it left a pretty good hole.
And I imagine your parents found out when you got hit. They probably got a telegram or something.
They didn't. I wrote and told them that I'd gotten hit and I was coming home, so don't worry about me. They didn't, I was home on a furlough when they got the information that I had gotten hit.
You mean you saw them before they knew that you were wounded?
Well, I told them I was wounded, but.
Okay, so you told them in person before letter actually arrived?
On a letter, I told them that I was wounded.
Yeah.
I did that when I was in Pearl Harbor.
Oh, I get it. Okay. This might be a tough one to answer because I get the sense that there's not a lot that slows you down. But there's got to be some kind of lasting impact of an injury that severe that basically blows off the top of your left shoulder.
Well, I can't raise my arm too high. I mean, when I got out, when I got discharged, they said, do you want to stay around for a medical discharge? And I said, how long will that take? Well, they don't know. I said, if I can get out now, I'll take it. I'll go now. So they did. They gave me a 20% disability, and I got that for about 2 years, and they called me up and said for another examination to see what it was, and they found out that I should have been getting 40% disability. So they gave me that. It was retroactive, which didn't amount to too much, but it was still quite a bit. So I've been getting that ever since. But I think if I would have stuck around for a medical discharge, I probably could have gotten 50%.
And as far as the way it is today, or for all these years, have you had pain or it's just kind of limited mobility?
Just limited, but it bothers my golf swing. I don't have any backswing at all. They tied the tendons too tight, so that's why I can't raise my arm too high.
Uh-huh.
But it doesn't bother me that bad.
So you were already home when Japan surrendered.
Yeah, I was home on a furlough.
What was that like for you after every, I mean, you've been at some pretty significant battles against these guys.
Well, I remember my cousin and I went deer hunting. As soon as it was over, we took off, went up to the ranch deer hunting for the weekend. Everybody was celebrating in town, and we went off by ourselves deer hunting.
How much have you told your kids and grandkids and great-grandkids about this over the years?
Very little. I mean, once in a while, they'll ask me questions, and I'll tell them something, but I just never cared to even talk about it, really.
You're glad to get home and didn't need to live in the past.
That's right, yeah. I worked for the Gilroy Lumber Company about 25 years. I retired when I was 55. I had a stroke. Some friends and I were fishing in Idaho, and I had a stroke there. I was in intensive care for a few days, and finally my wife and one of my sons came up, and a son-in-law took a motor home and picked me up and brought me home. But they wondered what caused the stroke. They gave me all kinds of tests when I got home. Just about 2 weeks before I left to go fishing, the doctor cut a piece of shrapnel out of my neck. And when he was cutting, I could feel it clicking in there on my windpipe. I says, that clicking my wind? No, he says, don't worry about it. He says, there's a lot of things more important than that. He says, it's right on the carotid artery. And I think that's what happened when a chunk of something got in that carotid artery afterwards.
Sure.
That's what caused it.
And you still have pieces of that shrapnel in there.
Yeah.
About how often does one of them work its way to the surface?
Oh, every 6 or 8 months a piece will come out. In fact, my wife pulled one out some years ago. It was just like a little fish hook. And she pulled it out, and it had about an inch piece of my jacket still hanging on the piece of shrapnel.
Your jacket had been under your skin for all those years?
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. Yeah. When you think back on that time, and obviously this is a lot of nights spent in foxholes, a lot of days in combat, a lot of close calls, that closest call we just heard about. But what are the things that today maybe you still think about and say, you know, somebody was really looking out for me there, or I'm really proud of how I handled that there?
Well, it's a sense somebody was looking out for me, that's for sure. As far as handling things, the one thing that started me off right, when I first went overseas, we went to Wellington, New Zealand, for replacements for the 2nd Division after Guadalcanal. So some of the guys that were on Guadalcanal were with us. We were getting ready to go to Tarawa. And this one sergeant told me, he says, when you land, make sure you don't go out. When they drop the ramp down, don't go out, go over the side of the boat. He says, if they have a machine gun trained on that ramp, it'll get everybody. So he says, go over the side. Mm. Well, I did. I didn't know how deep the water was, and I couldn't swim. But anyway, it was only up over my chest a little bit. But I remember that's something that probably helped me, just what he told me there.
Sure. You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because that was the question I was going to ask you that I forgot. With not being able to swim, was there ever a point during your time in the service where you thought that was going to be your undoing, where you found yourself in a situation?
I thought that might have been, but I was lucky enough. We were in close enough. In fact, I came in under a pier right afterwards. There was a little pier there, and I came in under that. But there was some of the ones behind me, they just drowned right there.
Mm-hmm. What are you most proud of with regard to your time in the Marine Corps?
I'm just proud to be a Marine, I guess. That's for sure. I mean, it was a good outfit.
Do you have some pride based on what collectively 16 million Americans in the armed forces and all the people back at home supporting them, what you were able to accomplish?
What bothers me are the ones that came back from Vietnam and Korea with the treatment they got. I didn't think that was right. I mean, we didn't get treated that way when we got home. We got treated as heroes, which the heroes are the dead ones, really.
More than 12,000 Americans would fit that definition of hero, Gold Star hero, in the Battle of Okinawa, which was in its beginning stages 80 years ago this week. When we come back, one of the first Americans ashore there details some of his closest calls. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Hey, do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for way too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I gotta tell you, when it comes to your money, I think I've found a better way with EECU. Just take a look at myeecu.org and I think you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a not-for-profit credit union that's all about taking care of you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Over 350,000 members now in 12 different California counties, and access to more than 30,000 co-op ATMs and free online and mobile banking. What I love most is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. A decade ago, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. By the end of this year, more than 2,000 veterans will have visited their memorials for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement that EECU takes oh so seriously. Pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 1-800-538-3328.
proudly presented by Provident Payments. This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and a special episode marking 80 years since the Battle of Okinawa, World War II's last major battle. Of course, if the atomic bombs hadn't been dropped 4 months later, there would have been a far bloodier invasion of mainland Japan. Back on April 1st, 1945, one of the first Americans to step foot on Okinawa was an 18-year-old with Navy Beach Party Number 62 named George Chrisman.
Easter Sunday, we climbed out of the cargo ship, lounged cargo nets, loaded ourselves onto the Amtraks because they weren't sure what the beach was when you get into the beach with the ship. So we went on the Amtraks. We gathered out. It was still dark. Gathered around a big circle. We had Easter sunrise service there with the chaplain. And after the chaplain had the Easter sunrise service, we left for the beach. And about that time, my commander, the beach master, had his radio, and all the big ships started shelling the beach where we were going to land to clear it further. And then as soon as we got near the beach, stopped that shelling, and the Amtrak continued on. The Army went ashore. About the third wave, we went ashore, dug our foxholes, set up the radio communications and beach markers, and started unloading ships. Very scary.
I would imagine so, and a pretty important role in that invasion. But you said the first thing you guys did was you had an Easter sunrise service. Do you remember anything about what was said there or what that meant to you to start that day that way?
Nope. Just scary.
Yeah. I imagine you felt like you were going to need some extra protection.
Oh, yes. Very much so.
And so you talk about the beach master and this landing party. So basically your guy's job was to get there first and set up some kind of organization so all these waves and waves and waves of troops coming ashore would be organized and going in the right direction.
Right.
Is that right?
The beachmaster's job is to direct that landing.
Uh-huh. It sounds like a pretty dangerous job, too, though.
Well, yes, it is.
Did you guys come under enemy fire?
Yes. We had a lot of Japanese up there in the mountains that were shooting at us.
Uh-huh. So what did you do?
Duck.
You had a foxhole and you...
Yeah, but the foxhole was only about a foot deep.
That doesn't do much good.
Because you had hard pan.
Uh-huh.
So you dug whatever you could and you lay down in there, and then it rained and we got full of water and... Didn't worry about the water. Just get down in there.
So what goes through your mind when you're in that foxhole and you still hear these rounds going off around you?
Hope you live for the next day. And when that first day, we looked up there and it was a little house about, 50 yards or 100 yards away. They were flying the Japanese flag.
Mm-hmm.
So about three of us went up there and first we called in for an American flag to be sent in. They sent the flag in. When we got the flag, we went over took the flagpole down. It's one of those flagpoles where you pull a pin out and the whole pole comes down.
Mm-hmm.
And we took the flag down. We put the American flag up and put the flag back, pole back up. And that little house that was there, we didn't know it at the time, but there was a guy up on the roof was shooting at a pair of people. So eventually, after we had the American flag up, we went up there with a couple of hand grenades and blew up the whole building. And he was down on the ground, dead. No,
but you didn't know he was there when you were taking the flag.
No.
He could have killed you.
Oh, yeah. And then after I took the flag down, I put the flag in my pocket. You got those jumbo pockets, and I put it in my pocket. When I got back on the ship 4 days later, I still had this flag.
Mm-hmm.
And when I got home, I put it in my treasure chest, and my daughter was going through my stuff for 4 or 5 years. Well, it's been about 10 years now. And she found this flag. Said, "What's this flag, Dad?" And I told her. I said, "That's the one we took off a flagpole in Okinawa." And so I folded it up and put it away, and I still got the flag now.
And I imagine there were a few American servicemen, whether they were Navy like you or Army or Marines or even Army Air Corps, that ended up on Okinawa because that was a long, drawn-out battle over a lot of territory. There are probably quite a few of them that ended up bringing a flag of some kind back. But my guess is yours might be the first one. Could anyone have grabbed a flag on Okinawa before you did?
Any one of the three that took it down. I cut it off because it was tied onto the pole.
Yes, but so there were three of you, but there was only one flag.
Right.
So you got that flag. And I'm just saying timeline-wise, because this is the first day of the battle, and you're in there early on, you were probably the first American to take a Japanese flag on Okinawa.
Right.
What was the significance of that for you, to cut down this Japanese flag not just to take it for yourself, but to put up in its place the Stars and Stripes.
Amazing. A lot of memories go by there. I look back at that flag and salute it and say, oh, there's my flag. Mm-hmm. It's our country.
And there was a long way to go in that battle.
Oh, yes. 10,000 a day was being killed.
And you'd be back on the ship for most of it.
Yeah.
But you did see some. So the first day on Okinawa, you're one of the first in. You take this flag. Still the Japanese are firing on you guys. How long did that day feel?
Seemed like it never ended.
Yeah?
Especially about dusk. When it got dusk, it was about 50 Japanese planes coming over. Those kamikaze pilots. Oh, they just blackened the sky. And here they come, and you just jump in your and dive into your foxhole. And these planes, terrible noise. They couldn't get any planes off because it was just about dusk. And they didn't get any planes off. So all the ships at sea were firing.
So you have a pretty good seat for this show.
Yeah.
The ships are close enough to shore that you can see them.
Oh, yeah.
And you see the kamikazes attacking them. Is that a bit of a helpless feeling? Or do you find yourself cheering?
Nothing you can do.
Yeah.
Just pray that you don't get hit.
Yeah, and pray those guys out on the ships are safe.
Because they've got some of those planes were hitting right near the beach, blowing up.
Mm-hmm. Did you lose any friends that day?
No. Luckily, we were on the beach, and the Army was moving ahead.
Uh-huh.
We had friends that got shot, but that's about it.
Uh-huh.
I got hit one time in my hand, but that's a small shell. You know, a small arm, so...
It was that day, or
reached
no?
Out, yeah. Reach down, pull it out with your teeth, because it burns. Burns like it's on fire.
Okay, you're saying that like it's not a big deal, but the rest of us, for the most part, have not been in these kind of situations. So you're 18 years old, you're on the beach on the first day of one of the biggest battles in the history of the world, and a bullet hits you?
Yep, you're scared.
So you're trying to direct troops who are still coming into shore?
Yeah, and call for whatever supplies they needed.
Uh-huh. That sounds like a pretty chaotic scene. It's probably just go, go, go.
It is go, go, go. You don't sleep for 3 or 4 days.
Literally.
You're up all night long calling the radio, and you might nap, but that's about it.
As troops come ashore, they keep moving inland, but you're staying there to keep things moving and coordinate what's happening. But in that job, you're on the radio, and did you know people were shooting at you, or did you just feel it out of nowhere?
You could hear them.
You could hear guns going off.
Yeah, the Japanese are... They had the cliff up there. It was mountains. And they had dug in big shoulders up on the cliffs. And they had trails. And they packed the dead bodies. They packed in front as a guard.
Uh-huh.
So they were looking over the dead bodies. And we ended up going up there and with hand grenades and sneaking up there and throwing the hand grenade in the cave that they had built so it would be, wouldn't be any more small arm fire.
But before that, you actually get hit in the hand.
Yeah. We didn't worry about that.
Well,
just a small one.
Well, what did it feel like? How did you realize what had happened?
It just burned like somebody hit you with a hot coals.
And you look down at your hand, and what do you see?
It was right here on the wrist.
Your left wrist.
You just reach in there, and nothing else to grab, and so you bite on it, spit it out, and burn your lips. And you do what you have to.
I'm sorry I'm laughing. I'm picturing this, and again... You're talking about this so mundanely, like this is something that just happens. But you have a bullet that lodges in your wrist, a hot piece of metal.
Yeah.
And you took your teeth and bit in and got it out of there.
Yeah.
You'd never done that before.
Nope. We've been trained, though, for first-line medics because there's no doctors on there.
Uh-huh.
So if somebody gets shot or a shrapnel or whatever, you can do a minor incision and take it out. If they break a bone, you feel with it.
Uh-huh.
And you find out what's the matter, and then you tape it up. Most of those guys were, I don't care, I'm going to go on. Get me well, and I'm going. My job is to fight. Give me my rifle.
So you'd been trained to render first aid if people were injured around you. But is that how you were trained to do it, to bite a bullet out of somebody?
No, you just do what you have to.
So when it hits you, you go ahead and you clamp down on the bullet and pull it out of there and spit it out naturally. Didn't think about saving it for your kids?
Nope.
You weren't thinking about ever being married or having kids at that point.
Saving your life. Your life is more important. Get it out of there.
So what did it look like after you took the bullet out of there? I imagine there's some blood, right?
Yeah, there was blood. It was sore. You push it back together as much as you can and put a bandage over it.
Uh-huh. You had to do that all by yourself?
Yeah. Put a little sulfur formaldehyde in it and bandage it up.
Well, just the fact that you got hit in the wrist That's a pretty close call, isn't it?
Yeah, cool. Yeah, I think it's pretty close to the old heart, but it's only a small arms, you know, like a 22 bullet.
Well,
so if it hits a bone, it's going to just smush her. And it's not going to be like a big 30-30 rifles that the Army was using.
Well, still, if it's in the right spot.
Oh, yeah.
That could be it for you.
The neck, the head.
Yeah. So you said you were scared before that happened.
And you're scared after.
More scared?
Oh, yeah.
And you have to keep doing your job.
Do your job.
And you said you guys didn't sleep that whole 4 days you were there?
You nap once in a while, but as soon as you go to sleep, there's something going on, blowing up someplace.
How did you do that? What do you think happened inside of you to enable you to carry out those duties, to stay awake, to keep fighting, to doing whatever you were doing?
Just the flow of adrenaline.
Yeah?
Just keeps you moving.
I'm imagining you had never experienced anything quite like that before.
Nope. No. I don't want to do it again.
Yeah. So what were those ensuing days like?
Oh, they tapered off a little bit when the Army kept further in, and the airplanes quit flying over.
Uh-huh.
So it got better. Got a little easier to take.
Was it more challenging in the dark than it was during the daytime?
No, more challenging in the daytime.
Why?
You had more Amtraks coming ashore. Amtraks coming back with somebody that's been shot, and all they want to do is get that bullet out or get that shrapnel out or whatever it is, and then go on. They don't even want to give you their name and their number. I'd get their name and number and turn it over to their officer so their officer could make sure that they followed up with the medics, that they didn't get any kind of infection or whatever, and got properly treated like in a hospital station. And then they put on their record that they'd gotten shot, you know.
Right. So you're helping people go in to battle in advance, but you've also got them coming back wounded. You're processing them. You got them coming and going.
Yeah.
You're a pretty busy guy.
Well, there's not that many.
Were you helping with first aid for some of them too, or
yes,
only yourself? So you had to help patch up some other guys.
We had a basic medical training.
Uh-huh.
Where we could do minor incisions and stuff like that. We had a kit there. You had to sharpen your knives and everything. It's not like the knives today are disposable.
Mm-hmm.
You had to sharpen them.
Can you give us an example of some of the things you had to do in caring for those wounded soldiers who came back?
Well, the one tank driver had gotten off his tank, and he'd gone ashore kind of looking around to see where he was going to go, and he stepped on a landmine. It blew his heel. The whole heel just opened up in his shoe. The heel part just opened up, and he come back and he'd got him back on the tank some way, and he came back and he wanted to see what he could do, so he got off and we looked at it, and it just peeled off like your sole under your shoe would just peel off. And I opened it up and took the tongue depressors and scraped it out, whatever's in there, and the blood and stuff. And then I put butterfly bandages. We had to make our own because they didn't have them. We made them out of tape, put that all around it, had to cut his shoe off to start with. And then taped his foot up with an ace bandage. And I said, why don't you just lay down here and we'll get somebody to take you back to the ship. I'm from a farm up in Oregon. He said, I don't need all that kind of stuff. He says, I just get me back on my tank. So he climbed back on the tank and away he went.
Wow.
And I had his name and his number. And I gave that to his officer. And so they checked it later. Then about, almost been 40 years later, I was up in Oregon, in Yahats, Oregon, where they have a big campground like. My wife's uncle was there, and we went walking to get the mail. And here comes some guy down the road limping, you know, kind of limping, walking away. He's older than I was. He was probably in his 80s by then. Come limping around, and he looks at me, and he's about 100 yards away, but he still sees me. And I hear this guy cussing at me, "USOB, USOB, you're the one, SOB." And my uncle says, "What's this? Are we going to get involved in something?" I said, "I don't know who it is." And I got closer, and he says, "You're the SOB that fixed my foot." And so I had to go up and meet his wife, and she was crying. You saved my husband's foot. He said, "If it hadn't been for you, he'd have lost his foot." Mm-hmm. I said, "Well, we do what we have to."
How fulfilling was that for you to see him again and understand how much it meant
good
to him?
It teared my eyes.
I believe it. It's bringing a little water to your eyes right now.
Yep.
Yeah, and probably a few people out there listening. So that's an example. Really, you're kind of a jack of all trades there on this beach in Okinawa.
Well, I've been lucky.
Uh-huh.
The good Lord blessed me with abilities to do a lot of things.
We've heard from two men who were wounded while on the island of Okinawa 80 years ago, but so many of the casualties suffered in that battle took place aboard ship because of the unthinkable volume of suicide attacks by Japanese aircraft. When this special edition of Hometown Heroes continues, a miraculous story of survival in the midst of one of those insidious incidents. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Ever feel like that dollar just doesn't go as far anymore? Well, join the club. Actually, you really should join the club. I mean, join the more than 350,000 members of EECU, the not-for-profit credit union now in 12 California counties. Free online and mobile banking, more than 30,000 co-op ATMs, and not just fair, but fantastic rates on auto loans, mortgages, and home equity lines of credit. Go to myeecu.org to become a member today, or just call this number, 1-800-538-3328. When times get tough and budgets get tight, a lot of businesses start slashing their marketing budgets, which all too often turns into a costly mistake. Instead, what if you could customize that investment to zero in on your target audience with surgical precision? And why am I saying what if? Because I already know you can with Search Strategy Marketing. It's not about how much you spend, it's about the strategy behind it. And Search Strategy Marketing is ready to prove it to you with a free, no-obligation assessment of your current efforts. Learn how to outrank your competition with a free, customized action plan just for Hometown Heroes listeners. Just go to hometownheroesradio.com and click on that light bulb logo for Search Strategy Marketing. It doesn't matter what your business is, Search Strategy Marketing can lead you to the best way to connect with your customers. So look for that light bulb logo today at hometownheroesradio.com and plug into the power that can take your business to the next level.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea, you're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler, brought to you by this local station and its sponsors. And presented everywhere, on the air and online, by Provident Payments, one of the fastest-growing payment consultants in America. Connect today at providentpayments.com.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes and our special episode marking 80 years since the Battle of Okinawa. Over the years, we've heard from veterans who participated there in the Army, the Navy, and of course the Marine Corps, fighting in air and land and sea. One of the more emotional Okinawa stories you can find at hometownheroesradio.com involved an Army veteran reuniting the wallet he captured from an enemy soldier who attacked his foxhole with a daughter in Japan who never really knew her father. The casualties on both sides were tremendous, especially when it came to the kamikaze craze, which reached a frenzied pace in World War II's last major engagement. Of the many kamikaze attack survivors we've met on Hometown Heroes is Seth Irving, who had grown up on the Oglala Lakota Reservation in Pine Ridge, South Dakota, and nearly lost his life at Okinawa aboard the USS Newcomb 80 years ago on April 6, 1945.
Well, they were coming directly from Japan, one thing. Before that, they were coming off of aircraft carriers, which they didn't have anymore.
Yeah, they were out of them.
Yeah.
Thanks to the Navy.
They ran out of them. But at Okinawa, they were coming directly from the island of Japan. Now, we went to Okinawa about 3-4 days and bombarded, and then the Marines came and Army came and landed. Then we went on picket duty, they called. All the destroyers were lined up around, kind of half circle around the island, and we were on the northernmost part of that circle. April 6th, 1945, approximately 4:35 o'clock, we got a report that over 500 kamikaze planes were leaving Japan.
And you still weren't scared?
No, we got prepared to fight.
Holy moly.
Yeah. And then, you know, we had a lot of aircraft carriers around. They released their, and they shot down approximately half of them. Or a little over a half. So there's only about 200 or something got through into the ship area. And that's when we got into it.
So you're on your 40-millimeter mount.
I was on my 40-millimeter mount, but I wasn't firing on anybody because my ship must have been going east. The planes came from the north. And so the port side, man. He was firing on them, but we were at a standstill because there was nothing coming past.
So you're just sitting there waiting to get something to shoot at.
Sitting there on our train, waiting for somebody to tell us there's a plane here or there. But the first kamikaze that broke through, I had a rangefinder. He was on the phone with the control. We told him where the planes were, and he would set the range on that gun sight. And he's the one that told me, he said, hit the deck, Seth, there's the plane coming. So I don't know how I did it. I unhooked, and I didn't hit the deck. By that time, it blew me into the water.
You didn't hit the deck because the plane hit your ship before you had a chance to hit the deck.
Yes. All I could see was planes coming. That's all I remember anyway.
Mm-hmm.
I must have lost it, but I wound up in the water.
So the impact of this kamikaze on your ship blew you right into the water.
Yeah.
Means the ship hit, the plane hit pretty close to where you were.
Yeah, it hit about the middle of the stack. And the stack that I was on threw me and bent over. And I guess that's what happened to me. But that rangefinder didn't make it.
A lot of guys didn't make it.
Yeah. No, I had a 10-man gun crew. I was the only survivor on that gun crew. Of the other gun crew, there was only one survivor off of that one. I was firing at it. And then after I got into the water, the propeller must have missed me by 2-3 feet.
So you're in the water, you're conscious, you're burnt, well, and this propeller is flying right at you? The propeller from the plane, or you're talking about?
Our propeller.
Your
the
ship. You almost got caught in the screws of the destroyer.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I must have been underwater because I could hear it just mumble. And I came up, and that screw, you know, was pushing the water, and it just pushed me out of the way.
Wow.
It pushed me about 100 feet or more away from the ship.
I'm sure you're still pretty stunned and dazed, but how much pain were you in?
I don't remember being in any pain. All I know is that when I was strapped in, I had a steel helmet on, I had a capot jacket on, and all of my clothes were gone. I was bare.
You were naked in the water?
Yeah. I didn't have no shoes. I was burned from my hair was all burned off to about my knee, all on the front side, you know.
So the explosion blew all your clothes off, your helmet off, burnt all your hair off, and burnt you from head to knee.
Yeah.
But you weren't in pain.
I don't feel pain. I don't know why. I just didn't feel pain.
What went through your mind when you realized what kind of condition you were in?
Survival, I guess. That's when survival takes over. I was in that water from about 4:30 until about 10 o'clock at night. Now, that was the scariest part because you start getting scared, you know.
Well, yeah.
Because of the sharks, etc. I was really scared. And during that period from about 4:30, 5 o'clock, there was a burnt life raft came floating by, and I jumped onto it. I thought I was going to get saved, but there was nothing on there. It was just burnt. And I was riding it along like that in the ship, and in maybe 2-3 hours, and it was getting dark, and I saw a silhouette of a destroyer sitting there. And I noticed that I was going to miss it by floating, you know.
Yeah, you're floating on this raft, and it's going to take you away from the destroyer.
Yeah. So I abandoned the raft. I figured even though that ship probably couldn't pick me up because they're still under attack, you know.
Yeah, it's not like you can hit the timeout button, come pick me up. They're still fighting each other.
Yeah. And so I was just about ready to get to that ship, and it took off. Of course, on that water, it just pushed me back out of the way. And there I was with nothing, just swimming by myself. I didn't have nothing on me.
So you're naked, you're burnt, you've already been in the water for 3 hours, and now your chance at survival just
vanished.
Went away from you.
Yeah.
Did you think you were going to die in that moment?
Yes, I did. I figured I don't think I could make it till morning.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, you hear stories about ships and survivors on life rafts for 4 or 5 days, some weeks, some. But I didn't think I was going to make it. Then it was pitch dark. And then I was floating and floating, and it was dark. And all of a sudden, I saw a flicker of light. Just barely saw it. I started screaming, you know. That light came right up to me, and they picked me up around 10 o'clock at night. And, of course, they gave me morphine and put me out within a half an hour, within 15 minutes while I was aboard that ship. I got up by the ship, and they were going to, guys came down on a
rope ladder?
Yeah.
To get you?
To get me. And they grabbed my hand like that, and that slipped and fell back into the water.
Did they just pull the skin off your arms?
Yeah.
Oh, ouch.
I was burned, you know. I didn't realize it either.
They didn't realize it either?
No, they didn't know it, you know. The next group came down, they raised me up out of there.
That had to be painful. Were you still kind of numb or in shock? Huh?
I must have been in shock because I don't even remember pain. All I remember, I was saved. I know that and within 15 minutes, I was treated, you know. Whatever they did was right. The next morning, that ship transferred me over to a transport that was transporting troops.
Uh-huh.
Was converted to a hospital ship,
mm-hmm.
and I was transferred to it.
You mentioned when you first found yourself in the water and took stock of the situation that you were concerned about sharks, about, you know, the enemy that was still firing away.
Yeah.
Did you see any sharks during those 6 hours?
Nope.
Good thing.
No. And another strange thing is I didn't see another body.
Nothing.
Nothing. I don't know if that propeller caught me alone and sent me out that way.
Yeah.
But I didn't. I looked and looked and looked because I was wanting to be picked up right away, you know.
I don't blame you.
Yeah. But I didn't see a soul. I was out there for them 6 hours alone.
6 hours?
Yeah.
How long did it feel like?
Lifetime, really. Oh, howdy.
I've talked to some guys who've been in similar situations in the water for a long time. And some guys will describe doing things to keep their mind occupied or thinking through different scenarios. Or some guys would say a prayer. They'd frantically, you know, try to get someone else's attention. What did you do? How did you pass that time?
I don't remember.
I mean, mentally, what was going through your mind? Were you saying a prayer? Were you saying, I'm going to make it? I know I can? I mean, how did you keep going? Where did you find that hope and that persistence to power through?
All I know is I had to survive, you know.
Yeah.
And I did whatever I could. I never saw a shark, and I never saw another human being in there. That burnt wrap was the only thing that I saw, and I should have stuck to it, but I didn't.
Well, what do you think would have happened to you if that raft didn't float by?
I probably would have died. I probably would have let myself die, for I was never a good swimmer, but I stayed afloat.
And that 3 hours made a big difference, I'm sure, to have that raft.
Yeah.
Another question that comes to mind, sorry for all my crazy questions, but you said something when that kamikaze hit, and again, you got the word that something was coming, and just before it hits, you unbuckle. If you did not unstrap yourself from that position, what do you think would have happened?
I would have been drowned. Because I think that, although that guy told me to unbuckle, and I did, and he didn't, because he didn't survive.
He probably didn't have time.
He must have not unbuckled.
Yeah.
And went down with the...
So the whole gun mount went into the water.
Yeah.
So you would have been trapped, if not killed by the impact.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or else drowned.
Yeah.
Because I don't know how far down it went. But I know I didn't go very far in because I came up and I just threw some salt water out. But it wasn't that much. So I must have just went in and out, you know.
And just the fact that of your 10-man crew, you were the only one to survive and that the other gun crew had the same ratio. I mean, that in itself says you beat some pretty significant odds to survive.
Boy, hardly we did. Well.
How do you explain it?
I have no answer to that because 84 of my shipmates died that evening amidships. All those torpedo men, they were right in that, and that stack was above an engine room.
Yeah.
And it blew. That was engine room number two. That blew the same time I got it. And all those guys didn't survive. There were some survivors. Of course, the first plane got me.
Yeah.
But there was four other planes hit that ship.
Five kamikazes on one destroyer.
Yes.
But it didn't sink.
It didn't sink.
Isn't that amazing?
It's amazing.
One well-placed kamikaze was plenty to sink a destroyer, if not a bigger ship, at other places in the war.
Right. Now, those destroyers were really built strong.
Well, so that ended the war for you, obviously.
Yes.
How long did it take you to recover from all this, and what was that period like?
You know, I was all bandaged up completely, so I didn't see daylight after I got on board that ship. My eyes must have been burnt bad.
You could see, but all the flesh around your eyes was burnt.
I didn't see anything.
In the water, did you see
anything?
No. In the water, you saw the light coming to you and all that.
In the water, I saw it after they treated me.
Right.
And they put stuff on me, and they must have put bandage that thick on me. Or I don't know what they did.
But anyway, they bandaged you from your head all the way down.
All the way down. I was bandaged all the way down. I was burned all the way down. And so I didn't see daylight until I got released from the hospital at the Guam Burn Unit. That must have been 30 days later.
Wow.
So I was without sight. I didn't see anything. But apparently I could see, you know.
But that you were just covered up.
I was just covered up.
Well, that's a lot of time to think.
Yeah.
30 days with no one to look at.
Yep.
You can hear people. You can't see them. What did you think about for 30 days? Did you think I'm going to go back home and go marry a girl from my reservation? Or what were you thinking about?
I was just thinking about getting well.
Yeah.
I didn't think about anything else, you know, and I wasn't the only one. There was 1,000 burn victims at that Guam burn unit, and I didn't know that until after they let me out.
When I asked you about how hard it was for you, one of the things you responded with was you were thinking about those guys that got killed on your ship. I imagine you knew a lot of those guys pretty well.
Well, not really that well, but I knew them.
The guys in your crew, your gun crew?
Yeah. I knew the guys in my gun crew, and I knew the guys who slept in my quarters, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I was the quarters captain. I had to keep order in the sleeping quarter area. That was one of my jobs before I go to general quarters.
That whole time that you were in the hospital and recovering, did you ever have any contact with family at all?
No.
Nothing?
Nope. They didn't know where I was, and I didn't know where they were.
You were even?
Yeah.
Well, I'm looking at your record here, and this says you were transferred back to your destroyer, the Newcomb, in August of 45, right before the end of the war.
Yes.
What was that like to get back aboard that ship?
All that time when I was still in the hospital.
Yeah.
It was towed back from Okinawa all the way to San Francisco. And, of course, I didn't know where it was at. I didn't even know it was still afloat.
Uh-huh. So they bring you back to San Francisco, and then you have 30 days survivor's leave. And they call it that because guys who lose people close to them in combat have that time to cope with it.
Yeah.
What did you do for those 30 days?
That's when I met her. Came back to Pine Ridge. I don't know exactly how I did it, because the train comes from San Francisco to Alliance, Nebraska, which is 90 miles from Pine Ridge.
Uh-huh.
And I must have caught a ride back. There were a lot of people from the tribe that was working at Alliance. They had a glider factory in Alliance, Nebraska, and a lot of the Indians from my reservation worked at that station.
Uh-huh.
And so there, I caught a ride back with one of them who was going back to Pine Ridge, you know. They left me there.
Were any of your family members there to greet you?
One of my distant family members was the only one there, so I stayed with her.
Tell me how you met your wife.
Well, I was home on 30 days leave.
Yeah.
And she was home for 30 days from school, nursing school.
Uh-huh.
We met then.
So the burn patient meets a nurse.
Yeah.
You'd known each other for a long time, but you hadn't thought of it this way before.
No. Huh?
So when did you realize that you need to ask Elfrida to marry you? Did you figure it right then on that leave, or did it take a while?
We got engaged, so to speak.
While you were home on leave?
Yeah. If you're a man, marry a nurse. She took care of me all of my life.
Have you had lingering effects of what happened to you there? Are there any things that you've had to deal with because of those injuries?
My answer is no. I don't know why. I just know that, well, I didn't like the Japanese for a very long time. But I must have gave up that thing because I bought me a Japanese car.
I know that you lived it and you've told the story for a lot of years. But are you ever amazed when you think about everything that happened and you realize that you survived?
No. The only thing I miss now is having that reunion with the ones that have survived. They all knew what I went through.
Yeah.
Yeah, they did, because they knew my story, and I knew their story, where they were at on the ship, and we never could figure out how we all survived.
And even after hearing him tell that story, it's a little hard to fathom, isn't it? 80 years after the Battle of Okinawa, the memories of those who were there give us just a tiny taste of what it was like and what a significant price was paid. Thanks for listening to Hometown Heroes today. I'm Paul Leffler, reminding you again that freedom is not free.
To let Paul know about a veteran in your life, visit hometownheroesradio.com and click on Suggest a Veteran. Today's program has been brought to you by Provident Payments. Give your business the edge only their personalized service can deliver at providentpayments.com.